I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
It wasn't just a bunch of hippie bands and denim and tie-dye.
You started, I think, in like junior high school, was it? And you learned the ropes pretty quickly, but you had various stages.
Sticks can't go with the shake, and the shake can't go with the bud. Yeah. And if there's some shake in your bud, you're getting penalized. And if there's some sticks in your shake, you're getting penalized.
And you were taking, by the way, large, massive doses of acid.
Can I just get over myself by dosing myself so hard that I will just lose my shit completely?
You know, I've always felt two whippets.
Yeah, I double the balloon.
Do a double. Always.
Cocaine was actually the means of exchange in Los Angeles.
I think that anyone who sells drugs that doesn't use the drugs they sell should be punished.
Only one dog gets killed.
Only one dog is killed. What the fucking hell was in it?
Do you think reality is a crutch for people who can't handle drugs?
Can I get a half?
All right, welcome once again. Is reality a crutch for people who can't handle drugs? Sheldon Norberg, author of Confessions of a Dope Dealer, joins us here today. And I look around me and I see Jeff Deal. I see Steve Robles. And
I see Steve.
And I see Diana Brown.
Hello, are you?
Yeah. Yeah,
when you look around like that, it reminds me of Romper Room with Miss Ruby.
There they all are.
But you know, I was checking out on Nouveau.net, and they reminded me that in 1972, President Richard Milhouse Nixon commissioned a report on marijuana. And he wanted to further substantiate marijuana as the demon weed it was portrayed as in the 1938 government-sponsored film Reefer Madness. But when Tricky Dick got his little report back, he wasn't so pleased. The response, the conclusion of his commission's report was, we would de-emphasize marijuana as a problem. Now, let's flash forward to 1988. In October, Francis Young, the chief administrative law judge of the U.S. DEA, came forward and said, nearly all medicines are toxic, they have potentially lethal effects, but marijuana is not such a substance. There's no record in the extensive medical library describing a proven, documented cannabis-induced fatality. That's a pretty broad statement. That's pretty amazing. So now here we are today, and a religion, many religions are jumping on this bandwagon. Another one has come out in support of medical marijuana. The Presbyterian Church has voted to support the legal access of marijuana for medicinal purposes. Now, this is pretty remarkable. I mean, we're all clamoring for the separation
The Rastafarian Church was years ahead of them.
See, yeah. There you go.
I think the Catholic Church should actually, you know, that they're trying to, you know, bolster their numbers because the Mormons are kicking their ass
majorly
in Mexico. I don't know what happened, but like...
What?
In Mexico?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Really?
Mormons, okay, so like starting like 20 years ago, I knew a bunch of Mormons and they're crazy, crazy people. And all they started sending their whitest, most... precious and pure blonde, you know, nymphettes down to Mexico to be missionaries. And they've been working the missionary deal down there for like about 20, 25 years. And now they're finally starting to kick some ass on the Catholics. So the Catholics are shitting themselves. So now they've got to figure out how to like reestablish themselves. I say they jump ahead of the Presbyterians and back medical heroin.
Dude.
What about just legalizing marijuana and... using it in the worship of Jesus.
See, there you go. They couldn't really if it's an herb burned at the altar of a deity. How could we get in trouble for that?
What if I just call myself a deity and I burn it at my own altar?
I think you do that night.
Yeah, I think that's narcissistic enough to.
Now, well, in this case, though, you get a tax break. I think if you can qualify as a religion, you know.
Yeah. Nice.
Well, there are plenty of religions who are on board here. It's not just the Presbyterian Church alone. The United Methodist Church, they passed a resolution by a vote of 877-19 a couple years ago, and they've been really active. But of course, you know, medicinal marijuana patients are still. They can still be arrested, and so regardless,
not in this town. That's why I say
they can by the feds.
No, you can't. No, there hasn't been a single user. The clubs get busted, but the users don't get
officially
busted.
Officially, they can. They
get yeah, still can. Federally, on a federal level, federal drug laws state that even those who have been told by their doctor they can smoke marijuana and it will improve their health, they can get busted.
Yes, the federal government has not crossed this line yet, and I don't anticipate that it will.
Once they round up all the illegal aliens, and you know they're going to have a little bit of spare room after the 11 million people are in those prisons for medical marijuana smokers, I think.
Yeah, but then I could just go to prison and sell pot to all those illegal aliens.
You know, but I was also reading in New Scientist magazine. Apparently, marijuana is just everywhere. And this gentleman named Francois Mach,
in his apartment, at least.
At the University Hospital in Geneva, Switzerland. He noticed all the benefits of medical marijuana on the immune responses to infections and cancer and things like that, and for AIDS patients. So he's like, I wonder if this might have some impact on, you know, the buildup of fatty deposits in arteries, reducing that inflammation. And sure enough, when his team fed 1 milligram of THC per kilogram of body weight, a low dose that should not have any psychotropic effects, darn it, to mice, they were susceptible to this fatty deposit of the arteries, it greatly showed progress and slowing progress in the development.
There's a kind
of
balancing out there, though, because you're going to eat fattier food.
See, exactly. If you're out with major munchies and you're like worried about the fries, you're choking down. THC can get in there and fix it all.
It evens it all out, basically. You know, no gain, no loss.
Personally, I haven't found a single problem on God's green earth that can't be solved by THC.
We're here with Sheldon Norberg, and he's the author of Confessions of a Dope Dealer, and he calls himself a progressive drug educator. Woo-hoo. And his performances naturally revolve around drug-related themes, and they've received rave reviews all over the country. And first, I want to let you know that we'll be gone next week for the 4th of July, because we're so patriotic. But we will be back the week after. And welcome, Sheldon.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, feel free to lean in as
yes, as you know,
close as you
what
feel
is, what is my mic volume here? Yeah, I can't spit on it. So
my good. First question is, are you ripped to the tits right now?
I am high on brain feeding at the moment. Let's see, what did I take? Some choline just to get myself back up, you know, for this discussion so I wouldn't pass out on the table.
Yeah, choline is good. Has your memory been improving over the years?
The thing that I found, when was it? I started taking it a year ago after Mind States, and I found out about the weird people's brain power stuff and choline, and I decided to start taking it to get ready to do the show again because I hadn't done the show.
Choline, is that some one of these?
It's an amino acid. It's one of
it's
the
sort of one of the precursors that helps to get the other brain drugs to be more active, but it helps with memory itself.
Yeah, memory and. Stimulates neurotransmitter function.
Right. But it's not prescription. It's
non-prescription, right?
No. It's an amino acid.
Right.
Arginine,
okay, so
choline, all that. So
offered with many of the products of the sponsor of our other program.
Oh, great!
Neophiles.
So you know that really helped me remember because I hadn't done the show for 8 months or something. I was heading into this run and needed to, you know, perfect the show, rewrite a bunch of it. I really tore it apart and rewrote it. I was like, I need to remember this and embed it really well. And because last July when I was doing it here, I was getting ready to go to New York, and I really wanted it to be, you know, everything that it could be by then. And
so anyway, going into your book and your experiences and so forth, you dealt mostly marijuana in the 1980s.
In the Wonder Years.
In the Wonder Years. Those beautiful 1980s, and you had all kinds of crazy, fucked up adventures. What would you?
It's hard not to.
What's the peak? What's the absolute? What would you say is the absolute weirdest adventure that you had?
Man, that's hard. Did you get to the part where I like? After a series of years of going to the Pinnacles and taking acid on the full moon at midnight in the middle of December, we went on the new moon in December and took 10 hits each and went to the bottom of the cave at Pinnacles at midnight and spent the whole night in the freezing depths of a, you know, subterranean cave.
I did read that part, yes, indeed.
That was pretty freaky. I was prepared never to recover my, sanity after that for some time. And, I wrecked my car and almost killed my friend and wound up, taking the Greyhound with a bunch of Mexican immigrants at 3 a.m. to try and trudge my way back.
Now, that wasn't the same one as the boat trip where you guys wrecked your boat and got stuck on an island.
That was very high. I must say that was a very high trip doing underwater nitrous. And it was... and I have one rule. The one rule I say about nitrous is never, while somebody's driving. I don't care who's in the car doing it. I don't want anybody in the car doing it while you're driving. If anybody in the car is doing it, it's bad news.
How about not over the speed limit?
Okay.
I draw my line a little bit differently. Okay.
You'll lose the speed limit pretty quickly. Those things sort of just go out the window the minute the whippet kicks.
Well, are you talking about a tank or a whippet?
Either way. People on a whippet,
I've always felt they'll jump out the window. Two whippets.
Yeah, I double the balloon.
Do a double,
myself.
Always. Yeah. Well, there's a whole thing up in my book about you always buy the big whippet bottle so you can do a double.
You were a very jealous nitrous tank manager in your book.
Well,
this became sort of a pathology of the control of the nitrous tank.
It's serious control issues, and I've got them, and I've had them, and I mastered tank nitrous distribution, and I go to parties where people don't know what they're doing, and it's just like, get me out of here. People, the guy who runs the tank is like one for me, one for you, one for me, one for the next guy, one for me, one for the next guy, and no one's getting any nitrous. I'm like, get it out of the tank, get everybody onto another, plateau of dimension, and watch them fall down, and try not to let anyone get hurt.
So you've noticed a lack of professionalism in nitrous.
This is exactly the thing, and there's all sorts of ego structure that goes out the window the minute you start hitting on the tank. But professionalism is something that in the drug dealing industry that I felt I grew up with in a very serious way. And you just see a lot of sloppy hacks in dope dealing, giving us all a bad name. And
it's the corporate takeover.
Yeah. I'll say this. One way I've seen it suffered is in the manicuring of weed. It's piss fucking poor. It's like it's shit that just would not pass back in 15, 20 years ago. And of course, the economics of it is the worse you manicure it, the heavier it is, so the less you're actually going to have to put in a bag.
There's a certain thing about people wanting to leave some cover leaf on to protect the trichomes and the schmint in there, but
not big fucking water leaves, though.
Yeah,
man.
No. There's a last place I trimmed. You ever heard of Pelican Bay Maximum Security?
Yeah, I lived in Arcata for 2 years.
Okay, so you know about the shoe? It's like the part of the California State Prison where they keep the 12 most gnarly murderers who would just kill you with their bare hands.
That's where they discovered on 60 Minutes that they were hosing them down with scalding hot water or something.
Last place I worked, they called it the shoe, and these guys have been growing weed for a while, and they call it, you have to be so gnarly to trim in there because they have such heavy duty rules, and they go in, they're checking your weed every hour. They're looking at every bag, and the sticks can't go with the shake, and the shake can't go with the bud, and if there's some shake in your bud, you're getting penalized, and if there's some sticks in your shake, you're getting penalized, and they're always kicking your ass like prison guards in there, and you gotta be tough and tight with your scissors to trim down there.
It's Pelican Bay, but you're still in the Emerald Triangle, man. Doesn't anybody care about the fucking rules anymore?
We could rework the system so that all of our prison inmates were given medical marijuana instead of whatever they force down their throats. But
well, I fully support that, but I want me to get it first. I nothing against it.
Well, you're here. I think all you got to do is walk down to DeViz, if I'm not mistaken.
To pay for it, though.
Well, yeah, there's
You had a bit of a wrap up to becoming such a professional in the dope growing that you had. You started, I think, in junior high school, was it? And you learned the ropes pretty quickly, but you had various stages doing the college thing.
Well, everything is, this period of time. I kind of observed for a long time as a little kid. I was hanging out in Berkeley as a young, as in seventh grade. I started hanging out in Barrington Hall, which is this linchpin of drug dealing in Western civilization. And, it's a co-op at the Cal, and by the time I was in high school, I had these unbelievable connections, and I sort of stumbled across the fact that I should probably exercise them. And so I did my high school dope dealing thing, and my college dope dealing thing, and my humble weed growing thing, and my dead tour dealing thing, and watched all of these different circuits evolving and devolving and expanding and contracting, and you know, what is the interface with your friends and your parents and your administrators and the law and, you know, politics and the army and, you know, whoever's getting called in at the next level to try and bust you for whatever you're doing.
What kind of time frame are we talking about here?
I started dealing in 79 in my senior year of high school. And the book pretty much goes through about 88 or 90. It's sort of oddly condensed at the end because it would just get too involved and long to be, you know, blah, blah, blahing about everything. I sort of, you know, after I quit seeing the dead, then things sort of shrink down to here's these, like, most intense trips that made me have to rethink what the hell was going on. But, you know, I started, you know, and the book starts when I'm, no, five, just kind of my first, you know, recollections and growing up in America and watching our terrible political situation and, you know, looking at the president as a criminal and, you know, being the narc kid. You know, I was the drug specialist kid in seventh grade who knew all about all the drugs and gave presentations. I was the junior narc and everybody thought I was a narc. And then, you know, I figure out the government's lying to me and my parents must be lying to me because they're coffee addicts. And, you know, maybe my brother, the hippie weirdo over in Berkeley, has some real information. I should go check out what's going on over there with these weirdos. And
so, one of the things I like about your book is, I mean, you're running around doing this shit, and you're dealing, and you're running around with a lot of dope in your pockets and your car and so forth.
Isn't everyone?
Doing really insane stuff that can easily get you in trouble. You don't seem to be too paranoid about getting busted, but you get really paranoid behind LSD about other things. Can sort of describe how your acid paranoia was
about? I think being busted is very straightforward and, you know, minimalist in the scale of cosmic shit that you're looking at when you're tripping that hard. Right. So, yeah, my paranoia about, you know, tremendous satanic conspiracies or, you know,
You thought everybody was keeping a secret, everybody knew a secret except you.
Well, you get into that solipsistic thing, you know, did I invent this world and am I just going to forget that my friend exists and he won't be here anymore, you know, or you're spatting around, you know, when you're that high, you know, getting busted is so minimal, especially if you've been walked through it a bunch of times and you've outthought the cops every time. They're either just not there, they're not smart enough, they're, you know, they're looking for your, you know, your registration instead of the pound in the trunk, you know, again and again. And, you know, they do have generally a high school, you know, diploma, which doesn't really qualify them for a whole lot of it.
And you were taking, by the way, large, massive doses of acid. I mean, people today are sort of used to, like, 60 microgram.
Well, yeah, I mean, I talked to somebody, you know, a couple of years ago, and they said, oh, man, I took 10 hits, and, you know, my doors are blown in, and then I, you know, found out it was one of these 20 mic hits. I'm like, right. Yeah, that's, you know, well, that's a starting place. But, you know, I, you know, after reading LSD Psychotherapy and, you know, thinking that there was no way I would ever, you know, be able to meet one of these, you know, psychotherapists who work with psychedelics, you know, I would just try these methods on myself. If, you know, I'll take the 1,000 mic dose and see if I can, you know, shatter my bulletproof, you know, already damaged ego and, you know, get over myself. Can I just get over myself by dosing myself so hard that I will just lose my shit completely? And it's a really hard tack to take and doesn't really work very well. You wind up tighter than ever.
See, like, I think that the acid has plenty of ego, you know,
build
dissolution, you know, capabilities. You
can
know.
Also build your ego, because once you learn how to deal with it, and you can become very solipsistic. And
you can be, you know.
That's exciting. And then this shows up in your book. You were sort of part of the generation that was sort of on the cusp between the idea that psychedelics and pot and so forth has this meaning around consciousness and the idea that it's a great big party. Of course, it was always both. But
the
you guys, you know, edged more towards the party.
Well, you know, it's what was going on. It wasn't just a bunch of hippie bands in denim and tie-dye. Everybody was wearing, like, you know, shiny, glittery clothes and flare-leg pants, you know? So it was kind of a different thing to be taking psychedelics and go see some band.
Yeah. But you were into the Dead. They were still pretty much...
I got into the Dead in college, and... And you know, you get into the dead and you think, wow, the dead is this really cool thing. And then you're kind of like, well, what the hell is going on here? You know? And I remember seeing that it was when their special from Madison Square Garden came out, and when they were interviewing a bunch of, you know, people about, you know, what is it about the dead that makes the dead such a great band? And one guy was just like, oh, it's the drugs. I was like, somebody got it.
We're going to have to break for a moment and hear some appropriate tunes, or a tune, actually, and we'll be right back.
Are you serious?
We are back. As far as the time frame goes, I was going to mention you must have been witness to the great price restructuring of that happened in the underground as far as marijuana.
Yeah, I will. No, I hit that. That's part of my book. You know, I will sell no pound at $5,000.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like I can't. You know, I can't do
there.
This.
There came a point around early to mid 80s where all of a sudden $50 an eighth became industry standard and not so shocking anymore. And what I always thought was interesting about this is it happened right around the time that in my neighborhood, I grew up in a suburb of South Central Los Angeles, right around the time that
Suburb of South Central.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to sit there and say I grew up in South Central because it sounded like I grew up in Compton. I grew up in Carson, which is
Carson.
Actually between Compton and Long Beach. And it happened right around the same time that crack started flooding the neighborhood. And an interesting thing happened where suburban kids who were just looking for kicks, who would have settled for smoking weed on a Friday night, weren't actually given the option of smoking weed on a Friday night because it was getting kind of Yeah, it was getting dry, and Reagan was really enforcing this whole thing, and that's when camp started blowing up big time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So these kids would instead, you know, roll looking for kids. Get crack.
Well, that's how crack got so big. Which
yeah,
is because
so. This happened with speed in like 1967, actually.
Once again, yeah. You know, the speed on the rotating, you know, right. Platform.
When Pot isn't around, that's
available
when,
now.
Now you, he brought up the subject of money, and I'm curious, how much money did you make, and how did you resist the thriving cocaine trade? You decided not to really go in that direction.
When I went to UCLA, which was just a tremendous cocaine school, and I was living on frat row, and we were in the funky anti-frat, but there were still three or four coke dealers in my frat, in a very small frat, and up and down the street there was, you know, 8 or 12 in every house, and there was, you know, kilo after kilo going on. And
I think cocaine was actually the means of exchange in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
And was actually way cheaper than pot at that point.
It was getting close, you know, but, you know, yeah, I mean, for really good pot, I mean, I started selling pot for 50 a quarter, and everybody was like, oh, what is with this? And then, you know, as I say in my show,
can I get a half?
The deal with Coke was I had three people giving it to me free anytime I wanted it because they thought it was so cool. And all I found was it, you know, gave me a pain in the nose and kept me awake and made us have boring conversations. And, you know, where, you know, I've been taking acid since I was 13, 14. Like, what are you doing with this weird powder that came from you don't know where and has been processed with you don't know what and it's going up your nose? And one of the guys, I made my first partnership with somebody, which I'll, you know, learned me never to do that again. And he started dealing blow. And he had great, you know, oh, I got this great blow connection. I'm getting blow from these guys in the valley. I'm getting this great blow. And so we got a melt point tester because he was starting to try and buy ounces or whatever. We never melted any cocaine at anywhere near, not only anywhere near the pure temperature at which it's supposed to melt, but at any temperature at which we could figure out what the fucking hell was in it. You know, what are you cutting this with 9 different ways? You know, we got to step on this again. You know, I always from the day I started dealing was like the best, tightest killer bud. You could never... There was never anything to fool anyone with. You know, when you start looking at the powder market.
I love this man's pride. He's still in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but you know, that's because you...
Here's the rockin' bud. You know, you hear, you know, this or whatever else. You know,
that's because you smoke it yourself, right?
Now I have this whole thing about, you know, I think that anyone who sells drugs that doesn't use the drugs they sell should be punished.
Yeah.
Should
including
be
the pharmacist.
Oh, you know, straight ahead. You know, take them down.
Yeah, see, so you want to be handling something that you... would want to handle on a personal basis.
Well, if you don't
too.
Care
I mean,
about your product, how can
too.
You know, how can you work in any industry not if you don't care about your product and don't understand your product? It's ridiculous.
Happens all the time. That's actually how I got into dealing pot in high school is my ability to the urban thing to do at that point was to these guys would take awful, horrible Mexican weed and like put it in a grinder and put it all in like in with the seeds and the stems and it was supposed to be horrible crap. And so what I did was I sold really good crap at the same price and just about got my ass kicked for it.
Because you were in Carson.
Because I was in Carson and there was a whole racial dynamic going in. So what I was able to do was side with the Samoans against the blacks. And it was really political.
Samoans, my Samoans, man, they're good.
I mean, and Samoans were the top of the food chain in Carson.
Yeah, everywhere, man. They just,
in football, you know,
Here is something you can't understand.
I want to add, there was a review of your book in TRP magazine by James Kent, and he wrote, Sheldon is not necessarily a likable character, nor do his actions reflect those of a well-meaning, self-aware individual. End quote.
I love him.
I can't think of a greater compliment.
It's lovely, isn't it? There's definitely some pretty serious irresponsibility in there, but
he's such a
actually
sharp
only
guy.
Only one dog gets killed.
Only
fire.
One dog is killed. But actually, we know my best friend does lose his mind and is still probably living with his parents and half waved out. And I can't take responsibility for that. He was doing drugs on his own. I didn't they weren't drugs I provided, and I wasn't hanging out with him that much. But he went to this dead show and ate a bunch of mushrooms and he became Jesus and could not come back down. And it was this total blow to all of us because he was such a smart, beautiful, groovy guy, Bob Bitchin, and everybody loved him. And, you know, he had to get taken home by his parents and recede into non, you know, being. And, you know, you see people who get blown out, and, it always has, you know, it's not about they took this drug. Right. It's like their world, you know, it pulled the pin on their world of personal stuff with their family, their parents, their, you know, demands on themselves and all the stuff. And it just happened to, you know, come out around this, you know, psychedelic episode that was not allowed to resolve properly because we don't, you know, allow people to use these medicines wisely or in the format that lets them process their whole trip and, you know, examine what was going on.
Right. In fact, they had something in Santa Cruz called the Psychedelic Emergency Network. I can't remember his name, but the guy you just referred to earlier, Groff. The idea being that when you get into one of these crisis points, this could really be a great moment for breakthrough.
Yeah, why are we wasting, you know, his deal is why are we wasting, you know, millions of dollars locking people up and giving them Thorazine when if we would just let them finish their trips and maybe give them more, you know, enough psychedelics to go into a serious trip, they could get through what, you know, whatever their thing is in, you know, 36, 72 hours. Maybe 3 weeks if it's really, really serious and life-changing. But we aren't prepared for that as a culture, or prepared to allow people to address melting down. You know, we have to be, you know, egotonic, you know, whatever we are. And, you know, the idea that you would go through some heavy transformation is, you know, wah, 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 you know, shaman, right, hippie, not, guru, not, fucking blah, blah, blah.
Don't you think that's a function of the whole, like, 5%, you know, nation theory, you know, the whole theory that only 5% of the populace of the world is even capable of connecting, you know, in any way with themselves and the truth that is around them. And it's probably never ever going to happen where the people who are capable are going to be in enough power to create that kind of reality.
Bummer.
It sounds really pessimistic.
Bummer.
But
like I keep liking to think that we'll just be able to evolve to, you know, whatever, you know, place we need to as the world is wiped out, but if you look at evolution,
if you look at like caveman evolution, we have to then kill those people.
But we have to think of humane and nice
good ways to kill them.
I have gone through years and years of since Reagan started of like how, you know, the aliens would come and give me some technology by which I could light all of them like on rectal fire, you know, and kill all of the Republicans or whatever. And and a while ago, I decided in some Buddhist you know moment that I should, you know, the aliens would give me a weapon that would I'd be able to fire it upon all the police and all of their clothing and weaponry and non-organic material of their cars and planes and, you know, ships and guns would melt into like an oxygen foam.
Shit.
But now, recently, I've come up with the idea that I will be given by the aliens a weapon which allows me to focus, some kind of electromagnetic wave on their brain, which will force them to release a bunch of DMT from their pineal gland.
Whoa!
Please do look into that.
The aliens just take them away to some.
They'll take themselves, and then they'll be interested in funding spiritual emergency centers.
Yeah,
as a drug educator, which is a lovely way of expressing in some ways what you were doing previously as a distributor.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there is no education without experience.
Do you think people are hipper about drugs now, or are they more stupid? Are they better educated?
Oh, they're tremendously more educated and stupider. you know, I mean, you look at the breadth of information. I mean, here you got Tikal coming out in the last 20 years. So there is that much more information.
And we should say what Tikal is.
Tikal, phenethylamines I've known and loved, and tryptamines I've known and loved, and now isoquinolones by Dr. Shulgin. So here's this reference library of information about psychedelics that this one guy has invented in the last 25 years. Who in our general population can absorb, you know, that much neurochemistry and psychology consciously, rather than go, wow, here's another, you know, drug I heard of on the internet and some guy says he's got it and I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the whole, you know, upswing of salvia, which is sold in, you know, extracted enhanced format to people who don't know what the hell they're doing with themselves, and they're like smoking it while they're driving their car. You know, I go to these podunk school in the middle of Texas, and this kid's telling me how they, you know, it would have been all right except for, you know, ripping through that farmer's fence and tearing the hood off my car and hitting that cow, you know. And like,
well, wow, this is the same kind of guy that would be like spraying paint into a bag if it wasn't for, you know,
being able to get salvia over
yeah,
the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Possibly, you know, that, and that's the thing that I hear from the, you know, kids who, you know, some the really straight kids who hire me, oh, I've never done any drugs, you know, worst thing I did is drink alcohol. I'm like, well, that is a known neurotoxin. And
there is this funny thing that, I mean, the school stoners are either like the stupidest guys or the smartest guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's
well, the interesting, the study that came out of England a few years ago.
It's weird that I say guys, because it does tend to go that way as well.
Well, I think the girls wait till they are a little more mature before they start drugging. But, you know, in England, this study was done and said that, you know, students with students with higher self-esteem are more likely to experiment with drugs.
Right.
So, and the students who, the whole thing about, you know, smoking pot, making your grade, making you fail, is that it's not weighted to the fact that students who are failing tend to start smoking pot. So the kids who are already failing in the school system or figure might as well get high. And that makes it look like, you know, smoking pot would lead to dumber students when it's entirely not the case.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and it's a question I asked at the beginning of my program. It looked like you were telling me to be quiet for a second.
We have one more question.
Anyway, do you think reality is a crutch for people who can't handle drugs?
I like to get back to it when I can. I tell you, so, you know, I've had some shaky trips.
Reality, like, or drugs?
No, reality. It's like, please, you know, give me this table. Give me this table at the end of a hard, you know, night of frying.
All right. Well, give us the schmear about how to find your book, and if you have any performances coming up, and the DVDs, and all that good stuff.
The book, the schmear about the book is, you know, whoever's listening to this is probably much more web savvy than me, and if you can figure out how to help me get like a really cheap front end shopping cart together with my PayPal account, you'll be the first person to get a free book, so I can sell the book over my website to other people. The show, I'm trying to do it at Burning Man. After kind of getting my butt kicked doing it here last year, I realized I might as well just fork over the dough and do it someplace where everybody can dig it. So if you're at Burning Man, look for me in the Entheon tent probably Wednesday and Thursday night. And other than that, I've got a new agent and working on my, you know, working on the lecture thing in the colleges, working on getting the shows out there. I've just joined the performance network for the Western States. I'm trying to actually bump it up into legitimate theater because it's gone really well the last couple of runs, and I think I'm ready to make my public statement as, you know, somebody who's used a lot of drugs and, you know, done a lot of research and would like to talk to people sensibly and intelligently about it.
And humorously as well.
Oh, I got a tongue in my cheek.
All right. I want to thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Are You Serious? And Steve says I should come up with a good ending for this program, but I don't have one yet.
Where's my lighter?
Yeah. This program was brought to you by absolutely nobody.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?